Welcome to the Story Weaver podcast. I'm your host, Bron Rauk Mitchell. Come sit with me under the story tree as I weave a tale or two for you.
Welcome to the Story Weaver's realm. I'm your host, Bron Rauk Mitchell, aka the Story Weaver. I am back with more of Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard Book. The man Jack set off down the hill in pursuit of the infant. From the shadows, the stranger watched Jack until he was out of sight. Then he moved through the night, up and up, to the flat place below the brow of the hill, a place dominated by an obelisk and a flat stone set into the ground dedicated to the memory of Josiah Worthington, local brewer, politician, and later baronet, who had, almost 300 years before, bought the old cemetery and the land around it, and had given it to the city in perpetuity. He had reserved himself the best location on the hill, a natural amphitheatre with a view of the whole city and beyond, and had ensured that the graveyard endured as a graveyard for which the inhabitants of the graveyard were grateful, although never quite as grateful as Josiah Worthington, baronet, felt that they should have been. They were, all told, some 10,000 souls in the graveyard, but most of them slept deep, or took no interest in the night-to-night affairs of the place, and there were less than 300 of them up here, in the amphitheatre, in the moonlight. The stranger reached them as silently as the fog itself, and he watched the proceedings unfold from the shadows, and he said nothing. Josiah Worthington was speaking. He said, "My dear madam, your obduracy is, well, can't you see how ridiculous this is?" "No," said Mrs. Owens, "I can't." She was sitting cross-legged on the ground, and the living child was sleeping in her lap. She cradled its head with her pale hands. "What Mistress Owens is trying to say, sir, begging your honour's pardon," said Mr. Owens, standing beside her, "is that she don't see it that way. She sees it as doing her duty." Mr. Owens had seen Josiah Worthington in the flesh, back when they were both alive, had in fact made several pieces of fine furniture for the Worthingtons' manor house out near Inglesham, and was still in awe of him. "Her duty?" Josiah Worthington shook his head as if to dislodge a stray strand of cobweb. "Your duty, ma'am, is to the graveyard and to the commonality of those who form this population of discarnate spirits, revenants, and such like wights, and your duty thus is to return the creature as soon as possible to its natural home, which is not here." "His mamma gave the boy to me," said Mrs. Owens, as if all that was needed to be said. "My dear woman." "I am not your dear woman," said Mrs. Owens, getting to her feet. "Truth to tell, I don't even see why I'm even here, talking to you fiddle-pated old dunderheads, when this lad is going to wake up hungry soon enough. And where am I going to find food for him in this graveyard, I should like to know?" "Which," said Caius Pompeius stiffly, "is precisely the point. What will you feed him? How can you care for him?" Mrs. Owen's eyes burned. "I can look after him," she said, "as well as his own mamma. She already gave him to me. Look, I'm holding him, aren't I? I'm touching him."
"Now see reason, Betsy," said Mother Slaughter. A tiny old thing, in the huge bonnet and cape that she had worn in life and had been buried wearing. "Where would he live?"
"Here," said Mrs. Owens. "We could give him the freedom of the graveyard." Mother Slaughter's mouth became a tiny O. "But," she said. Then she said, "But I never."
"Well, why not? It ain't the first time we'd have given the freedom of the graveyard to an outsider."
"That is true," said Caius Pompeius.
"But he wasn't alive." And with that, The stranger realized that he was being drawn, like it or not, into the conversation, and reluctantly he stepped out of the shadows, detaching from them like a patch of darkness. "No," he agreed, "I am not, but I take Mrs. Owen's point of view." Josiah Worthington said, "You do, Silas." "I do, for good or for evil, and I firmly believe that it is for good. Mrs. Owens and her husband have taken this child under their protection. It is going to take more than just a couple of good-hearted souls to raise this child." "It will," said Silas, "take a graveyard."
"And what of food and the rest of it?"
"I can leave the graveyard and return. I can bring him food," said Silas. "That's all very well you saying that," said Mother Slaughter. "But you comes and you goes, and nobody keeps track of you. If you went off for a week, the boy would die."
"You are a wise woman," said Silas.
"I see why they speak so highly of you. He couldn't push the minds of the dead as he could the living, but he could use all the tools of flattery and persuasion he possessed, for the dead are not immune to either." Then he came to a decision. "Very well. If Mr. and Mrs. Owens will be his parents, I shall be his guardian. I shall remain here, and if I have need to leave, I shall ensure that someone takes my place, bringing the child food and looking after him. We can use the crypt of the chapel," he added.
"But," expostulated Josiah Worthington, "but a human child, a living child, I mean, this is a graveyard, not a nursery, blast it."
"Exactly," said Silas, nodding. "A very good point, Sir Josiah. I couldn't have put it better myself, and for that reason, if for no other, it is vital that the child be raised with as little disruption as possible to the, if you'll forgive the expression, the life of the graveyard." With that, he strolled over to Mrs. Owens, and he looked down at the infant asleep in her arms. He raised an eyebrow. "Does he have a name, Mrs. Owens?"
"Not that his mother told me," she said.
"Well then," said Silas, "his old name won't be of much use to him now anyway. There are those out there who mean him harm. Suppose we pick a name for him, eh?"
Caius Pompeius stepped over and eyed the child. "He looks a little like my proconsul, Marcus. We should call him Marcus."
Josiah Worthington said, "He looks more like my head gardener, Stebbins." "Not that I'm suggesting Stebbins as a name. The man drunk like a fish."
"He looks like my nephew, Harry," said Mother Slaughter.
And it seemed then as if the whole graveyard were about to join in, each inhabitant offering his or her own comparisons between the infant and someone long forgotten, when Mrs. Owens broke in.
"He looks like nobody but himself," said Mrs. Owens firmly. "He looks like nobody."
"Then nobody it is," said Silas. "Nobody Owens." It was then that, as if responding to the name, the child opened its eyes wide in wakefulness. It stared around, taking in the faces of the dead, and in the mist, and the moon. Then it looked at Silas. Its gaze did not flinch. It looked grave.
"And what kind of a name is Nobody?" asked Mother Slaughter, scandalized.
"His name, and a good name," Silas told her. "It will help to keep him safe."
"I don't want trouble," said Josiah Worthington.
The infant looked up at him, and then, hungry or tired, or simply missing his home, his family, and his world, he screwed up his tiny face, and he began to cry.
"Leave us," said Caius Pompeius to Mrs. Owens.
"We will discuss this further without you." Mrs. Owens waited outside the chapel. It had been decreed over 40 years before that the building, in appearance a small church with a spire, was a listed building of historical interest. The town council had decided that it would cost too much to renovate it. A little chapel in an overgrown graveyard that had already become unfashionable. So they had padlocked it and waited for it to fall down. Ivy covered it, but it was solidly built and it would not fall down this century.
The child had fallen asleep in Mrs. Owen's arms. She rocked it gently, sang it an old song, one her mother had sung to her when she was a baby herself, back in the days when men had first started to wear powdered wigs. The song went, "Sleep, my little babby-o, sleep until you waken. When you've grown, you'll see the world, if I am not mistaken. Kiss a lover, dance a measure, find your name and buried treasure." And Mrs. Owen sang all that before she discovered that she had forgotten how the song ended. She had a feeling that the final line was something in the way of, "and some hairy bacon," but that might have been another song altogether. So she stopped, and instead she sang the one about the man in the moon who came down too soon. And after that she sang, in her warm country voice, a more recent song about a lad who put in his thumb and pulled out a plum. And she just started a long ballad about a young country gentleman whose girlfriend had, for no particular reason, poisoned him with a dish of spotted eels when Silas came around the side of the chapel carrying a cardboard box. "Here we go, Mistress Owens," he said. "Lots of good things for a growing boy. We can keep it in the crypt, eh?" The padlock fell off in his hand and he pulled open the iron door to the crypt. Mrs. Owens walked inside, looking dubiously at the shelves and at the old wooden pews tipped up against a wall. There were mildewed boxes of old parish records in one corner, and an open door that revealed a Victorian flush toilet and a basin with only a cold tap in the other. The infant opened his eyes and stared. "We can put the food here," said Silas. "It's cool, and the food will keep longer." He reached into the box and pulled out a banana. "And what would that be when it was at home?" asked Mrs. Owens, eyeing the yellow and brown object suspiciously. "It's a banana. A fruit. From the tropics. I believe you peel off the outer covering," said Silas. "Like so." The child, nobody, wriggled in Mrs. Owen's arms, and she let it down to the flagstones. It toddled rapidly to Silas, grasped his trouser leg, and held on. Silas passed it the banana. Mrs. Owens watched the boy eat. "Ba-na-na," she said dubiously. "Never heard of them. Never. What's it taste like?" "I've absolutely no idea," said Silas, who consumed only one food. And it was not bananas. "You could make up a bed in here for the boy, you know." "I'll do no such thing. With Owens and me having a lovely little tomb over by the daffodil patch, plenty of room in there for a little one. Anyway," she added, concerned that Silas might think she was rejecting his hospitality, "I wouldn't want the lad disturbing you." He wouldn't. The boy had finished his banana. What he had not eaten was now smeared over himself. He beamed, messy and apple-cheeked. "Nana," he said happily. "What a clever little thing he is," said Mrs. Owens. "And such a mess he's made. Why, attend you, little wriggler." And she picked up the lumps of banana from his clothes and his hair. And then she said, "What do you think they'll decide?" "I don't know. I can't give him up, not after what I promised his mamma." "Although I have been a great many things in my time," said Silas, "I have never been a mother, and I do not plan to begin now. But I can leave this place." Mrs. Owens said simply, "I cannot. My bones are here, and so are Owens. I'm never leaving." "It must be good," said Silas, "to have somewhere that you belong, somewhere that's home." There was nothing wistful in the way he said this. His voice was drier than the deserts, and he said it as if he were simply stating something unarguably. Mrs. Owens did not argue. "Do you think we will have long to wait?" "Not long," said Silas, but he was wrong about that. Up in the amphitheatre on the side of the hill, the debate continued. That it was the Owenses who had got involved in this nonsense, rather than some flippity-gibbet, Johnny-come-latelys, counted for a lot, for the Owenses were respectable and respected. That Silas had volunteered to be the boy's guardian had weight. Silas was regarded with a certain wary awe by the graveyard folk, existing as he did on the borderland between their world and the world they had left. But still... A graveyard is not normally a democracy,
and yet death is the great democracy, and each of the dead had a voice and an opinion as to whether the living child should be allowed to stay. And they were each determined to be heard that night. It was late autumn, when the daybreak was long in coming. Although the sky was still dark, cars could now be heard starting further down the hill, and as the living folk began to drive to work through the misty night block morning, the graveyard folk talked about the child that had come to them, and what was to be done. 300 voices. 300 opinions. Nehemiah Trott, the poet, from the tumbled northwestern side of the graveyard, had begun to declaim his opinion, although what it was no person listening could have said, when something happened. Something to silence each opinionated mouth. Something unprecedented in the history of that graveyard. A huge white horse, of the kind that the people who know horses would call a grey, came ambling up the side of the hill. The pounding of its hooves could be heard before it was seen, along with the crashing it made as it pushed through the little bushes and thickets, through the brambles and the ivy and the gorse that had grown up on the side of the hill. The size of a shire horse it was, a full 19 hands or more. It was a horse that could have carried a knight in full armour into combat, but all it carried on its naked back was a woman, clothed from head to foot in grey. Her long skirt and a shawl might have been spun out of old cobwebs. Her face was serene and peaceful. They knew her, the graveyard folk, for each of us encounters the Lady of the Grey at the end of our days, and there is no forgetting her. The horse paused beside the obelisk. In the east, the sky was lightning, gently, a pearlish pre-dawn luminescence that made the people of the graveyard uneasy and made them think about returning to their comfortable homes. Even so, not a one of them moved. They were watching the Lady on the Grey, each of them half excited, half scared. The dead are not superstitious, not as a rule. But they watched her as a Roman augur might have watched the sacred crow's circle, seeking wisdom, seeking a clue. And she spoke to them. In a voice like the chiming of 100 tiny silver bells, she only said, "The dead should have charity." And she smiled. The horse, which had been contentedly ripping up and masticating a clump of thick grass, stopped then. The lady touched its neck, and it turned. It took several huge, clattering steps, and then it was off the side of the hill and cantering across the sky. Its thunderous hooves became an early rumble of distant thunder, and in moments it was lost to sight. That, at least, was what the folk of the graveyard, who had been on the hillside that night, claimed had happened. The debate was over and ended, and without so much as a show of hands, had been decided. The child called Nobody Owens would be given the freedom of the graveyard. Mother Slaughter and Josiah Worthington accompanied Mr. Owens to the crypt of the old chapel, and they told Mrs. Owens the news. She seemed unsurprised by the miracle. "That's right," she said. "Some of them don't have ha'porth of sense in their heads, but she does. Of course she does." Before the sun rose on a stormy grey morning, the child was fast asleep in the Owens's fine little tomb. For Master Owens had died the prosperous head of the local cabinet makers' guild, and the cabinet makers had wanted to ensure that he was properly honoured. Silas went out for one final journey before sunrise. He found the tall house on the side of the hill, and he examined the three bodies he found there, and he studied the pattern of the knife wounds. When he was satisfied, he stepped out into the morning's dark, his head churning with unpleasant possibilities, and he returned to the graveyard, to the chapel spire, where he slept and waited out the days. In the little town at the bottom of the hill, the man Jack was getting increasingly angry. The night had been one that he'd been looking forward to for so long, the culmination of months, of years of work. And the business of the evening had started so promisingly, three people down before any of them had even had a chance to cry out. And then it had all gone so maddeningly wrong. Why on earth had he gone up the hill when the child had obviously gone down the hill? By the time he had reached the bottom of the hill, the trail had gone cold. Someone must have found the child, taken it in, hidden it. There was no other explanation. A crack of thunder rang out, loud and sudden as a gunshot, and the rain began in earnest. The man Jack was methodical, and he began to plan his next move. The calls he would need to pay on certain of the townsfolk, people who would be his eyes and ears in the town. He did not need to tell the convocation he had failed. Anyway, he told himself, edging under a shop front as the morning rain came down like tears. He had not failed. Not yet. Not for years to come. There was plenty of time. Time to tie up this last piece of unfinished business. Time to cut the final thread. It was not until the police siren sounded, and first a police car, then an ambulance, then an unmarked police car with a siren blaring sped past him on their way up the hill, that, reluctantly, the man Jack turned up the collar of his coat, put his head down, and walked off into the morning. His knife was in his pocket, safe and dry inside its sheath, protected from the misery of the elements. Finally, after all those months, we have reached the end of the chapter. I will be back next week with Chapter 2, or as much of Chapter 2 as we can fit in. Thank you for the continued support, it means a lot. And I've got some exciting interviews coming up over in the next coming months.
The Story Weaver podcast intro and outro were created by my editor and tech whiz, Paul Aiken, using licensed music from Stock 20. If you would like to contact me, you can send me an email to thestoryweaverpodcast@gmail.com. Farewell for now, dear friends.